the suggested areas, but it is that sort of opposition, however small and however local. Can all that be overcome, never mind when it comes to actually building all these homes and infrastructure?
Well, it can be overcome because Labour's Planning and Infrastructure Act, which received royal assent just before Christmas, will make it easier for the government to get planning through. And they've been talking really tough on what they're going to do if large developments of 300 homes or more are not approved. They can do it. Of course, they can overrule at a local level. But I think the really interesting question... Yeah, well, will they and should they? I think this is, to my mind, actually one of the biggest challenges this government have got. I do think, I travel up and down this country week in, week out. We have a huge problem, and I think it's the right thing to do to regenerate communities and build. But if you're saying to people, we're doing this whether you like it or not, is that right? And what will that mean in future elections when people who had concerns didn't feel listened to? I think that's something the government should be a little bit more worried about.
Vicky Spratt, housing correspondent for the iPaper, thank you very much for talking to us about the new towns. And you here in the studio, Fee Glover and Jane Garvey, are ready for their programme coming up next.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you very much, Joe. Good afternoon. It's 2 o'clock. You're listening to Jane and Fee here on Times Radio.
And in the next couple of hours, we'll hear live from the Prime Minister. MPs are grilling him on his response to the conflict in the Middle East. And we'll analyse what he says with the Times policy editor, Ollie Wright. Iranian involvement in an arson attack on a Jewish charity's ambulances hasn't been ruled out. We'll talk to the journalist Nicole Lampert. Vassos will bring us the sport, including 3 gold medals for Great Britain's female athletes at the World Indoor Championships. And there is good news too. Most of us are wrong about how dishonest our neighbours are.
First, the news with Eliza Phillips.
Thanks, Fee. Good afternoon. Donald Trump has ordered his military to pause all strikes against Iranian power plants for 5 days. He made the announcement in a Truth Social post, claiming he made the decision after successful talks with Iran. Iranian media claims it shows the US president's backed down. Well, Middle East commentator Tara Kangalu says Tehran will see this as a victory.
The Iranian regime will take this as a win because for them, they will project this image and this narrative that we stay true to our regime and we are in power and we're intact. We haven't crumbled.
Counter-terrorism police are leading an investigation into an arson attack on 4 Jewish community ambulances in North London. It's being treated as an anti-Semitic hate crime in Golders Green. Officers are looking into the legitimacy of a group claiming responsibility online. There have been no arrests yet made. CCTV shows 3 hooded men approaching one of the vehicles and setting it alight. Mike Freer used to be the Conservative MP for the area. He says that whenever something is happening in the Middle East, there's a spike in anti-Semitic attacks.
It's sad that people cannot differentiate between what is going on in the Middle East and what is a, you know, a British Jewish community that simply want to get on with their lives and practice their faith quietly. No doubt there'll be more calls for more patrols, more policing, more security. And whilst that's welcome, it doesn't actually address the underlying problems that we have, people who feel that the Jews are a fair target, and we have to address that.
The Prime Minister is holding a COBRA meeting, looking at every option the government has to help people cope with the economic impact of the conflict in Iran. Sir Keir Starmer is to discuss the financial fallout with cabinet ministers and the Governor of the Bank of England. 2 pilots have been killed after their passenger plane crashed on the runway at New York's LaGuardia Airport. The Air Canada jet collided with a fire truck, which has been called to another incident. Land on the outskirts of North London and a Bedfordshire village are among the chosen locations for new towns in England. 7 developments are planned, which ministers say will involve the building of up to 40,000 homes. They'll be designed to include things like schools, transport links and healthcare. Housing Minister Matthew Pennycook says they'll benefit the whole country.
Bringing forward large-scale new communities, whether they're standalone settlements or urban extensions, is a means of addressing the housing crisis, allowing people who are desperate to buy their first home or get an affordable home to rent to get that place where they can live securely and to unlock economic growth.
And Scotland's busiest train stations reopening fully on Wednesday. A partial timetable has been operating at Glasgow Central since last week, more than a fortnight from a fire at a nearby vape shop. For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Good afternoon. It is 4 minutes past two. It's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio. Let loose this afternoon because reasons you don't really need to know about. There's a bit of building work going on here, isn't there? And we're on our own. We're on our own in the studio. We're completely untethered. There's no adult here.
Usually when we look through the glass, we've effectively got minders who make sure that we say the right things at the right time. And we've got legal representation. We've got all kinds of things going on next door. But today there's nothing. And there is a little bit of a feeling in the studio. I don't know. It's a bit like when all of the teachers are called to an emergency staff meeting and the pupils are left on their own. Anything could happen, kids.
Don't worry, it probably won't. 0333 003 2353 is the WhatsApp, as ever. What's happening between now and four? Well, the Prime Minister is appearing before the House of Commons Liaison Committee. As ever, he'll get a grilling because this is the opportunity for the... Is it the chairs of committees, the individual committees like Foreign Affairs and all that stuff?
It's a bit, it can be a pile on. Yeah, I think that's the technical term, Jane.
Let's be honest, it's the chance for some more obscure and relatively obscure politicians to make a name for themselves and get properly stuck in to the beleaguered Prime Minister. So we'll talk about that. You'll hear a bit of that as well. In a miserable world, there is a bit of brightness. It turns out we're actually more honest than you might think. More on that later. We've got the tech news. We always do on a Monday. Chris Stokel-Walker joins us. What qualifies somebody to be the BBC Director General? Well, I googled that and you'll never guess what Google came up with. It says the candidate would need a complex combination of creative leadership, editorial judgment and high level corporate management experience. So why not appoint Matt Britton, who used to work for Google? It all makes sense, doesn't it? Do you see what I did there?
I do see what you did there. Yep. You basically... You asked the butcher to rate the meat.
That's it. Do you live in one of the best places in Britain? Today we're going to hear it for Richmond in Surrey, which we were talking about earlier. It is lovely, but it's the plane noise. I mean, I wish it well, but I'm sorry. They often have a good panto on, but the planes are overhead every couple of seconds, aren't they? Let's just acknowledge it. Nice park as well. But the planes. Vassos Alexander will discuss a golden display by Team GB at the World Indoor Athletics. And it's Literary Salon Monday. Susie Goldsborough joins us after 3:30. She'll talk about David Kynaston's classic social history, Austerity Britain, and personal finance with Adam Shaw at about 10 to 4. This week on Holding Your Nerve in Troubled Times. Do you stick with stocks or bung any savings you might have in a cash ISA? So that's all to come between now and 4 o'clock.
0333 003 2353 is our number this afternoon. Anything that Jane and I are talking about, we love it if you're discussing it with us. Let me tell you about the most read stories on the Times website so far this afternoon. In at number three, and this is the story that we will go to next, Golders Green Fire, Iran may be behind Jewish ambulance attack. The second most read story is that Air Canada plane crash, two dead at LaGuardia Airport in New York. And the most read piece on the Times website is the Iran war latest. Trump suspends power plant strikes. The US president is ordering a 5-day stop to attacks on energy infrastructure, saying negotiations with Iran are ongoing.
So the discussions took place yesterday. They went into yesterday evening. They want very much to make a deal. We'd like to make a deal too. We're going to get together today. By probably phone, because it's very hard to find a country. It's very hard for them to get out, I guess. But we'll at some point very, very soon meet. We're doing a 5-day period. We'll see how that goes. And if it goes well, we're going to end up with settling this. Otherwise, we'll just keep bombing our little hearts out.
bombing our little hearts out. Okie dokie. In the UK, Keir Starmer will hold a COBRA meeting today on the effects of the war. And as Jane said, we're going to hear from the Prime Minister shortly at Parliament's Liaison Committee. You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You do need your digital subscription. If you don't have one, get one. You can go to thetimes.com/subscribe. Let's talk about events overnight here then in the UK. Security services and the police fear that Iran could be behind the arson attack on ambulances belonging to the Jewish volunteer Hatzolah organisation in London. The Times reports that Tehran's involvement in the attack overnight hasn't been ruled out. Metropolitan Police Detective Chief Superintendent Luke Williams gave an update to the press at the scene today.
CCTV footage appears to show three people in hoods pouring accelerant onto the vehicles before igniting them and fleeing. While this has not been declared a terrorist incident at this stage, the investigation is now being led by counter-terrorism policing, with all the specialist expertise they bring and all lines of inquiry remain open. We are aware of an online claim from a group taking responsibility for this attack. Establishing the authenticity and accuracy of this claim will be a priority for the investigation team, but it is not something we can confirm at this point.
Well, there are reports that the group claiming responsibility for the attack is the Iran-aligned Islamic Movement of the People of the Right Hand, though, as you heard, police have yet to confirm that. No injuries were reported, though windows in nearby buildings were damaged by exploding cylinders in the vehicles. Sir Keir Starmer condemned the attacks in a statement earlier today.
Well, this is a horrific anti-Semitic attack. And, of course, my thoughts, I think all of our thoughts, will be with those in the vicinity, the residents who are understandably very concerned, a Jewish community across the country deeply concerned. I've already been in touch with community leaders this morning and will continue to do so during the day. But anti-Semitism has no place in our society, and it's really important that we all stand together at a moment like this.
Well, let's talk now to Nicole Lampert, who is a journalist covering the story. Nicole, a very good afternoon from us. I mean, this could so easily have been much, much worse, couldn't it? Do you think that that has been an adequate response to this attack?
When I think about the fact that just a few months ago we had two people killed at a synagogue, and the response was just, here's a bit more money to make yourself more secure, then I think that we have a much bigger problem, which is just that the causes of this are not being fully addressed. The Jewish community is not being properly protected, and I'm not sure how that changes.
What would proper protection in your eyes look like? What does it need to be?
I think that we need to have a proper conversation in this country about anti-Semitism, about anti-Zionism, and how the two are both Jew hatred. I think we need to stop radicalisation in our universities, in our schools, in our NHS. We need to talk about the fact that this anti-Zionism is Jew hatred. Look at the Green Party. They are on Friday, they're going to be discussing the motion, or Saturday, about whether Zionism is racism. So they are adding to this increasing level of radicalisation against Jews. So I'm not surprised that this happened. It wouldn't surprise me if more Jews are killed. And this is how fearful I'm speaking as a Jewish journalist, how I feel and how many in my community feel. Like, you know, what will be done apart from a few platitudes and, oh, this is terrible?
You do have personal experience, I know, of the Hatzolah ambulances. Can you just tell us a little bit more about what they actually do?
Yeah, so they're a voluntary ambulance service like St John's Ambulance Service. They were formed in the 1970s in New York in America when an ambulance didn't arrive to someone in time. They could have saved him. He'd had a heart attack, I believe. And since then, different Hatzolah organisations have sprung up, and they are particularly useful at a time, obviously, we all know how difficult it is to get an ambulance, the many calls on our NHS. So they've been set up in mainly Jewish areas, and they work with the NHS, they work with the ambulance service, to the point where I spoke to a couple of Hatzolah volunteers today, and they said the ambulance service will phone them and say, we've got this going on in your area, can you pick them up? So Jewish people or anyone can phone them directly, but also the ambulance service will say, there's just someone in the area that you work in. So my father, a few years ago, he had a fall, and we called the ambulance service and they said it'll be a few hours. My aunt said, try Hatzola, and someone came over in 5 minutes, and he was taken by ambulance to hospital. Sadly, a few weeks ago, he basically had a heart attack and was unconscious. And my mum called Hatzola. They said call 999, but the Hatzola man was there in 5 minutes, and he stayed with my mum all night while people worked on my dad to try and save him. Sadly, they didn't. But I think it was good for her to have someone like that with her the whole time, and to advise her on kind of next steps as well.
Well, Nicole, I'm so sorry about your father. Our thoughts are with you on that tragedy, and thank you for talking so readily about your experience. So anybody can call a Hatzola ambulance, although funded by a Jewish community. They aren't solely for people within a Jewish community.
That's right. Anyway, I mean, you have to depend on what area you live in. So the area I live in isn't covered by Hatzola, so they tend to be in very Jewish areas. But anyone can call them, and they will come. And I spoke to some people, and it's amazing the kind of voluntary, the hours that they put in. So they're trained in the same way that paramedics are trained, but they're all people with full-time jobs or jobs. Some of them are medics, some of them are paramedics, some of them are doctors. And then the person I spoke to today, he's a restaurant owner. He's been through years of training, and he's literally ready at the drop of a hat. He's on call 24 hours a day to go. And this includes most of them are religious Jews, but this includes going at times such as Shabbat when you're not meant to drive and you're meant to be going to synagogue. They'll drop anything because saving a life is deemed more important than anything else in the Jewish religion.
What will this attack mean to those operations?
I think it puts Hatzola under a spotlight they may not want to be under. Obviously, there's a lot of pressure on them. They've lost 4 ambulances, although West Streeting has offered 4 ambulances. It may also mean that more people are aware of them, so more people might call them. But also there has been fundraising for them, which has been quite amazing to see. I think around 300,000 has already been donated to them this morning.
Iran's involvement, Nicole, hasn't been ruled out by the security services. I wonder what your thoughts are about that.
Well, a couple of weeks ago, I hosted an event with Lord Warney and a British Iranian called Kazra Arabi, and it was about how Iran uses our charity system to radicalise people in this country, and how the Charity Commission isn't adept enough to close down radicalisation. And at the time, Kazra said to me, things are about to get a lot worse for both the Iranian community and the Jewish community. And I messaged him this morning to say, you know, I've been thinking about what you said, just because I've seen that this group that has said it was them, they have been attacking synagogues across Europe. They're a new group. Not many people know about them. We don't know whether they are Iranians that have come in or they are basically Iranian agents that have been activated. But certainly we also know that MI5 talked about how there were 20 attacks or attempted attacks from IRGC Iranians just in the last year. We know that there were arrests just earlier this month. So
yes, there has been evidence, and the government has been very clear about sharing that evidence with us. Can I just go back to what you said, though, Nicole? Can you just explain that criticism of the Charity Commission?
So basically the Charity Commission is basically really set up to look for dodgy accounting. It's not really good enough. It's not there to spot radicalisation. So when there have, for example, been a radical trustee, the charity will get rid of the radical trustee, and then the Charity Commission will allow that charity to continue. So Lord Warney was calling for the Charity Commission to basically beefed up, and this was particularly to do with Iranian charities that are sponsored and often have members that are literally like friends of the Ayatollah.
Right. I mean, it's such a difficult one, though, isn't it, Nicole? Because obviously not every Iranian involved in a charity organisation in this country would be allied to the Ayatollah or the current regime.
Of course, yeah. So it's about making sure that they can see where the dangers are. For example, I'm sure that you would have talked about the Al-Quds March. The organisers of that are officially a charity.
Yeah.
So this is one of the problems, and it's not just that kind of extremism as well. There's all sorts of probably extremist organisations that the Charity Commission isn't able to handle. And so also sometimes these investigations from the Charity Commission will last for years, and they'll stop when there's a police investigation, and only then will it start up again. But in the meantime, the charity is allowed to continue as a charity,
right,
making money and radicalising people.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, a very detailed and meticulous scrutiny is needed at the moment. We're almost out of time, Nicole, and I would just like to give you the opportunity to just tell us, as you are, you know, speaking for others in your community, what is needed from everybody right now?
I wish there was an easy answer. I think we need to really acknowledge that there is this hatred. We can't just pretend it's on the surface, but it's below, it's deep below, it's underneath. Over the last few years, I've looked at anti-Semitism in our unions, in our universities, in our schools, in our NHS, and it's everywhere. And we need to, yes, investigate it, but we also need to call it out. We need to probably beef up hate law, hate crime speech, so that it includes Zionism. So, for example, you know, just I was at a university recently, and there's people outside screaming Zionists off our campus. So most Jews are Zionists. In fact, most probably people in this country are Zionists, but they're talking about Jews. They're talking about any Jew who believes in the state of Israel. Mm.
Nicole, thank you very much indeed for talking to us today. Nicole Lampert is a journalist who has been covering all of the stories that she mentioned there, but in particular the attacks that happened against the ambulances last night.
Right. Coming up on Times Radio, we're going to discuss something a bit more positive, a lot more positive. The fact that actually we're often more honest than we might give ourselves credit for. That is next. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Every Monday to Thursday afternoon, hear an agenda-setting one-hour programme hosted by the best talent from the Times and Sunday Times newsroom.
This is the Times at One with me, Stephen Sacker.
Good afternoon, I'm Trevor Phillips.
Hello, it's Daniel Finkelstein.
I'm Joe Coburn.
Good afternoon, this is the Times at One with Andrew Neil.
Unpacking the day's big talking points with a lunchtime menu of the latest news from the UK and around the world. The Times at One. Tomorrow afternoon from 1 on Times Radio.
My dad is more than just a dad. My dad provides life-changing support to those affected by disaster and conflict, helping people in crisis, whoever and wherever they are. Through the gift that he left in his will to the British Red Cross, my dad still makes a difference to the world, even though he's no longer with us. You can make a difference too. Please go online and search Red Cross Wills and consider leaving a gift in your will to the British Red Cross.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Let Wix install your new kitchen. Choose from a wide range of kitchens and add the option of installation to your order. For complete peace of mind, all installations include a 2-year workmanship guarantee. Get started by booking a free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
It's a common assumption that people will lie if they can get away with it. But new research happily suggests otherwise. A study by the Norwegian School of Economics looked at 31 different scenarios involving anonymous lying for profit. They found that nearly two-thirds of us are wrong about how dishonest our neighbours really are. Let's talk to one of the co-authors of the study, Jarif Matuza. Hello, Jarif. How are you?
I'm great. Pleasure to be here and thank you for the invitation.
Well, it's a great pleasure. Now, tell me about some of the scenarios that the participants in your study were faced with.
Yeah, so we ran a bunch of scenarios where we gave people the opportunity to lie to make more money. And then we asked them to estimate out of 100 people how many would do the same. In a scenario that we used a lot is we asked people to guess a number of a die, 1 to 6, in their mind.
Yeah.
And then just self-report if they got it correctly or not. So statistically, 17% of the people should be getting it correct if we are running it with thousands of people. But if, let's say, 30% people get it correct or say that they got it correct, probably suggests that quite a few of them are lying in their reporting to increase more money. Because if they say they guessed it correctly, they make more money.
I see.
And
yeah, carry on.
Yeah, so in these games, after they have made their own decision, or sometimes even before they have made their own decision, we ask them, in the same situation, out of 100 participants, how many do you think would falsely report that they had guessed the correct die roll? And if their guess is between one of the most accurate ones, then they get $2 more bonus to make sure that people are putting in enough effort into making these estimations. And what we consistently find is people overestimate what percentage others are dishonest. So we find that around this overestimation accounts to a bit of 14 percentage points. So to contextualize, let's say 33% people cheat on average, let's say 10,000 people, then probably on average they would estimate that 47% of them have cheated. We also did some granular analysis to try to see, is it driven by some people who just think everyone's a cheater and most other people who are quite accurate? But it turns out not to be the case.
Can I interrupt? Because I'm interested, I suppose, in why all this matters, Jarif. And is it that we behave in a certain way? Our behaviour is governed because of our lack of trust in the rest of humanity. But actually, we could change our behaviour because people are not as bad as we might think.
Yeah, so we think this matters a lot because in a lot of situations, we can never know if lying is going on or not. We're having this conversation, or when we are filing taxes online, it's not always clear that the objective truth can be determined. So in these cases, we form beliefs about whether and to what extent people might have been truthful or not. So if we seem to have this tendency to overestimate the dishonesty of others, we might invest more in surveillance, in monitoring. And as you point out, if we trust others less, then we might forego opportunities where we could have had mutually beneficial outcomes.
Yes, exactly. And can you remind us of quite a famous study called The Lost Wallet, where people at the old chestnut, where they find a wallet, it's stuffed with money. And what happens then?
Yeah, so that was a fantastic study that came out in Science, I believe. These group of really top scientists dropped wallets in front of government institutions all over the world. And they wanted to see is if they return the wallet to that institution and say that, hey, I'm in a bit of hurry, I need to go, but can you make sure this wallet reaches the owner? What they found is a lot depended on how much trust was there in a particular country. So they ran it on, let's say, 80 or 100 countries, right? And they found that countries that had higher levels of trust, the wallets were more likely to be returned and with the cash intact. Interestingly, the authors first thought that maybe wallets with more cash would be less likely to be returned on average, but it turned out not to be the case, if I remember correctly. I think it was the wallets with more cash that were more likely to be returned with the cash intact. So that was quite surprising. And after the study was run, the authors wanted to see, okay, can people predict the results of the study, right? And they got experts in economics and also everyday people to make predictions on what percentage of wallets did everyone thought would get returned, and would it matter if the wallet had more cash or less cash. And there they consistently found that people's beliefs were not so calibrated with reality. Most people thought that wallets with more cash would be less likely to be returned, and wallets with less cash would be more likely to return. A bit of the opposite of these authors really found. So this study became one of the inspirations really for us to kind of try to figure it out that, okay, so this was civic honesty. Can we test it in a more controlled and experimental setting and focus on specific dishonest behavior and beliefs about it?
Thank you so much for sparing us some time. And it's a bit of a bleak world at the moment, so we do need some positivity. We're very grateful to you. Thank you. Jarif Matuza. Kieran says people may not lie for $2, but if it was $200, yeah, but I wonder whether that is the same. I mean, if you find a wallet and it's got £300 in, as our guest Jarif was just saying, people are more likely to return it. Would it be the same if you knew that you could win a straight $200 for telling a porcupine? I don't know. Are they're not the same, are they, those two things? Or are they? Frank wants to know why he's lying. Yes, ho-ho. And Stuart says integrity is about doing the right thing even though nobody's watching and nobody will ever know. I mean, that's the ultimate test, isn't it?
That is, isn't it? Mm. So is the difference in those two scenarios that one you kind of happen upon and the other is rather a deliberate thought process?
Yes, exactly. That is the difference. There's a clear distinction. So I shouldn't muddle the two. My fault.
No, but I'm muddling my unmuddling here. I don't know, to be honest, I think it depends if it's a wet Wednesday or a very sunny Tuesday.
Glyn says, please tell me there isn't a test afterwards. Right, you're sacked, Glyn. Thank you very much. Where are we? It's Times Radio, isn't it?
It certainly is. Coming up, we'll dip into the Prime Minister answering questions on the UK's defence strategy. That'll be calm. First, the news headlines with Eliza Phillips.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thanks, V. Good afternoon. Donald Trump says the US and Iran have held very strong talks and says they very much want to make a deal. That's despite the Iranian Foreign Ministry in state media claiming no discussions have taken place. The US president's postponed threatened strikes on Tehran's power plants. Counterterrorism police are leading an investigation into an arson attack on four Jewish community ambulances in North London. It's being treated as an anti-Semitic hate crime. Officers are looking into the legitimacy of a group claiming responsibility online. There have been no arrests so far. Nicola Lampert is a journalist. She says Hatzola Ambulance Service treats everyone.
The ambulance service will phone them and say, we've got this going on in your area, can you pick them up? So Jewish people or anyone can phone them directly, but also the ambulance service will say, there's just someone in the area that you work in. So my father, a few years ago, he had a fall and we called the ambulance service and they said it'll be a few hours. My aunt said, try Hatzola, and someone came over in 5 minutes and he was taken by ambulance to hospital.
Well, the Prime Minister is currently answering questions on the international situation. We'll bring you more later. The Mayor of New York's praised the swift actions of first responders after an Air Canada plane hit a fire truck on the runway at LaGuardia Airport. The pilot and co-pilot were both killed and 41 people on board have been taken to hospital. And homeowners' choice of mortgage deals has shrunk by almost a fifth in the past few weeks. This morning there were almost 1,500 fewer options available compared to 2 weeks ago. For News Bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
In a world of noise and uncertainty, IG is the investment platform that backs you. Take our flexible stocks ISA, which gives you the freedom to withdraw funds anytime and replace them in the same tax year, all without losing your £20,000 tax-free allowance. And if that's not enough,
Pay no commission on your stocks, shares and ETFs when you invest with IG. IG. Trade. Invest. Progress. Your capital's at risk. Other fees may apply. Tax treatment depends on individual circumstances and is subject to change.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Save up to 50% on kitchen units with the Spend and Save offer. And for a limited time, there's an extra 10% off. Terms and minimum spend apply. Find your nearest kitchen showroom at wix.co.uk.
John Pienaar takes over from us at 4 o'clock this afternoon. Hello, John.
Hi there. Hello. So, what's going on? So I'm looking at Keir Starmer. He's now doing his regular question session with senior MPs, which may or may not be of interest, oddly enough, for the Prime Minister. It isn't always of interest, but who knows? We're going to watch that for something. There's a lot to talk about, including the British position on the war on Iran and the cost of living in this country. He's going straight from there to a meeting of the COBRA Emergency Committee in Whitehall to talk about the cost of living. So we're watching all of that. And, of course, the big story earlier on when Donald Trump posted suddenly that he had withdrawn, at least for 5 days, his threat to start attacking power stations and installations in Iran, which could have triggered off a catastrophic tit-for-tat of energy attacks in that war. So you start off that conversation when you hear from the president in that way with a big announcement by asking, do we believe what he says? It's odd that you ask that question about a serving president, but that is the question you have to ask. And I'm talking to a cast of witnesses and people with testimony and expert knowledge, including an American general. I'm talking to Tim Marshall, the always reliable foreign affairs analyst. I'm talking to a former State Department official, Karin von Hippel. And along the way, also talking to Rachel D'Souza, the Children's Commissioner. This really remarkable story about who knows how many children, because nobody does know, who are now stuck in hospitals because there's nowhere else for them to go. No home, no family home to go to, no place in care, nowhere. They're stuck there, in some cases, for years. And Rachel D'Souza has done a report on that, so we'll hear about that. And the French elections, I could go on, but there's a lot on the programme.
Absolutely. And John takes over from us at 4 and squeezes it all in before 7. We are going to head straight to Westminster now. As John said, the Prime Minister is currently appearing before the Parliamentary Liaison Committee. The session is focused on international affairs and the UK's defence strategy. I think that's where we're going to join him.
Sarah Sackman, the MP for Golders Green, is keen to see an uplift in neighbourhoods of policing in neighbourhoods with large Jewish populations. And I'm sure you would want to say something about that and what the latest update to the public about that investigation.
Yes, if I may, Chair, I'd really welcome that. Can I start by expressing my disgust at this horrific anti-Semitic attack in Golders Green in the early hours of this morning? The idea that ambulances could be considered a target is simply horrendous. And I know the impact that that will have had on so many individuals, not just those in the area. And I've been with Sarah Sackman this morning, the constituency MP, but also the neighbouring MPs, but also, frankly, the whole Jewish community across the country, not least because this is not an isolated incident, and the rise of anti-Semitic hatred is there for all to see. In relation to the ambulances, I spoke to the Health Secretary this morning, and I can confirm that we will replace the ambulances that were destroyed in the horrendous attack. London Ambulance will have the replacements ready by tomorrow morning at the latest, so I'm really pleased to be able to put that support immediately into place. And also to say that the NHS will pay for the permanent replacements that are going to be needed in due course. That is the right thing to do, but it also underscores what I think is a really important principle, that this is not just an attack on the Jewish community, but it's an attack on all of us, on everyone who holds the fundamental British values of tolerance and respect. Chair, I also met Jewish community leaders at Downing Street this morning, along with some members of the Cabinet and local MPs to the area of the attack, to discuss the actions that we were taking to keep the community safe. Can I thank them for attending at such very short notice? There are a number of actions coming out of that meeting, including speeding up aspects of the social cohesion strategy that's been published, the support that's available for the CST and other measures. But the idea that we live in a society where people should feel they need to hide their identity or their religion is frankly abhorrent. Anti-Semitism is an old hatred, but it requires constant vigilance to overcome it. And so let me be clear, we won't rest in our fight to defeat this poison and keep the Jewish community safe. Chair, I've got wider updates on the position in Iran and the Middle East, but I think I'm in your hands. I could do it now and take some time, or I can try to weave it into questions, which I suspect
will be on the issue. I think we'll come to some of that in questions, and we'll make sure that you've got time at the end, Prime Minister, to update the country on anything that we haven't covered in that time. But can I thank you on behalf of the committee for that statement? And I think there's great relief that the swift action to replace the ambulances is good. Will you be looking at increasing policing in areas with large Jewish populations, as Sarah Sackman has requested?
We've discussed that this morning, and I've already actioned some discussions with the Home Office about that. I won't go into the specific details here, but just to rest assured, that is one of the issues.
Appreciate it's not 24 hours yet. So
no, we did discuss it this morning. Sarah Sackman raised it, and we're already taking action.
Thank you. And speaking from a borough which has also got a large Jewish community,
I should emphasise that, of course, this is in that constituency, but right across the country, there will be concern, and that's reflected in the discussions we had this morning.
Thank you for that, Prime Minister. And as you say, there's big things happening in the world, and the Iran war and its economic impacts are obviously of crucial importance. I'm going to ask Liam Byrne, MP, to kick off.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much for that statement, Prime Minister. I know you're chairing COBRA on the war in Iran later this afternoon. Things are moving very quickly and the fog of war remains thick, but what is your central planning scenario for how this conflict ends, and what's your view about the timeframes?
Well, my very strong view is we need to de-escalate and bring an end to this conflict as swiftly as possible, and we've been working with a number of countries in that regard, and to that end I welcome the talks reported between the US and Iran. And to be clear with the committee, we, the UK, were aware that was happening. And the immediate priority has to be a swift resolution of the conflict and delivering a negotiated agreement which puts tough conditions on Iran, particularly in relation to nuclear weapons. So that's the sort of number one priority. Obviously, there's no certainty in this, and that's why, in addition to the usual issues at COBRA meetings, which are often military, diplomatic, consular, we're holding a COBRA this afternoon on the economic impact, because my strong sense is that most people are very anxious and concerned at what they see on their television screens in terms of the conflict and the fear of escalation. But they're also very concerned about the impact it might have on them and their families. And that's what we will be absolutely focusing on this afternoon.
President Trump is obviously talking about days and weeks for this conflict to end. The markets are obviously pricing now for a disruption that lasts for some months. I know you've got to be very careful about not triggering panic buying of anything. But, I mean, do you think that households and businesses in our country should be planning for a disruption that actually lasts for months? Or do you think that actually this can be concluded in days and weeks, as President Trump seems to suggest?
Hard to answer that question, if I'm honest about it. I think all of our focus and energy has to be in the swift de-escalation, but we've got to plan on the basis that it could go on for some time, and that's the way in which we'll plan this afternoon. And since the conflict started, I've been really clear with the team that we mustn't fall in to the sort of false comfort of thinking that there will necessarily be a quick and early end to this. We have to plan on the basis there may not be. In terms of energy has been where a huge amount of focus has been. On energy supplies, I can reassure the committee that we haven't any meaningful concerns about energy supplies. Obviously, the price fluctuates daily. For household energy bills, it is important for me to reiterate that they will be cut because of the measures we took in the budget last year and then held until the end of June. And I know that for many members of the public, the question they've been asking is, does that still hold even if the conflict goes on? And the answer to that question is yes. So there's comfort there for households. Obviously, fuel duty is held until September. We've been working intensively in the last week or two with fuel suppliers, particularly petrol retailers, to make sure that nobody but nobody is profiteering from this, and that's why we've said to the CMA they've got to be all over any price gouging, any attempts to make money. And we've taken measures in relation to households that use oil for their heating, which is predominantly rural communities, and quite extensively in places like Northern Ireland, where 68% heat their households by oil. They're the immediate measures. This afternoon, we will be looking at a wider set of measures for the economy and specific sectors within the economy, and the Chancellor will then make a statement to the House tomorrow. So we'll have COBRA later on, which I will chair, and then the Chancellor will come to Parliament tomorrow to announce the outcome of the COBRA meeting so that there can then be questions in Parliament in relation to that.
Thank you.
Well, that's where we're going to leave the liaison committee. Of course, we'll keep our ears across that for you. As Liam Byrne said, it is an ever-changing political and military landscape. An hour or so can make a difference to the story. So here's a quick roundup of the very latest. The US has postponed planned attacks on Iranian energy infrastructure for 5 days. Oil prices have dropped after Donald Trump said the US and Iran have had productive conversations regarding a total resolution of hostilities. Iran's foreign ministry has denied this, though the US president dismissed that in an interview a little earlier today.
So the discussions took place yesterday. They went into yesterday evening. They want very much to make a deal. We'd like to make a deal too. We're going to get together today by probably phone, because it's very hard to find a country. It's very hard for them to get out, I guess. But we'll at some point very, very soon meet. We're doing a 5-day period. We'll see how that goes. And if it goes well, we're going to end up with settling this. Otherwise, we'll just keep bombing our little hearts out.
Well, President Trump had threatened the attacks if Iran didn't reopen the vital Strait of Hormuz, through which a fifth of the world's oil travels. The president suggested that the war could end with the US sharing control of the strait with Iran.
What about the Strait of Hormuz? Who's going to be in control of that?
That'll be opened very soon, if this works.
How soon? And who's in control of it? Will Iran still be able to control the flow of oil?
Be jointly controlled.
By whom?
Maybe me. Maybe me.
You want the United States to be in
me control? Me and the Ayatollah, whoever the Ayatollah is, whoever the next Ayatollah.
Well, we do need to keep across it all of the time, don't we? And we then bring you the highlights. So we will carry on talking about all of that after 3 o'clock on the programme. We've got a lot to pack in between now and then, though.
Oh, we have. Oh, it's just worth saying that we did get a message earlier from a listener who was more than disgruntled and claiming, here we are, it's Lawrence. I haven't heard any mention of the lack of comment by Sadiq Khan, London's mayor, about what happened in North London in terms of the Hatzolah, the Jewish ambulances, for, though not exclusively for, the Jewish community in that part of London. And it's just worth saying, Lawrence, and anybody else who's interested in that, the mayor has come out, Sadiq Khan has come out and condemned the attacks and promised more police patrols in that area. So sometimes you can't hear everything and you begin to suspect that certain people haven't come out and said stuff. Well, he has. So don't worry about that.
Coming up then, why Luke the Nuke is trademarking his face. You're listening to Times Radio. It's Jane and Fee with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
The Story, the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Sorry to interrupt your day, but I've just been diagnosed with dementia and I'm going to need your help. I'll need help when I can no longer button a shirt or recognise my own family. My daughter will need help too. I worry this could ruin her life. And we will all need help to find a cure to end the devastation of dementia. I can't do this alone.
It will take a society to beat dementia.
Alzheimer's Society.
At QuickFit, our customers drive away happy every time. Do we tell them jokes? No.
All right.
We just do our job, but don't take our word for it. Take the word of thousands of excellent customer reviews on Google and Trustpilot.
There's loads.
That's why our customers drive away happy. QuickFit. Drive away happy every time.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
It is 12 minutes to three. Let's take a closer look now at one of the regional winners in this year's Sunday Times Best Places to Live, sponsored by Lloyds.
The Sunday Times Best Places to Live on Times Radio, sponsored by Lloyds. Spotlight on London winner, Richmond.
Well, I'm Mark Edwards. I'm a boat builder, and we're here at Richmond. I'm looking out from the boathouse doors at Richmond Bridge, lovely stone bridge built in 1777. Well, I'm a traditional wooden boat builder, building and repairing and designing relatively small boats normally for rowing and sailing on the river. It's very historic. We're very lucky here on the waterfront that since 1780, nothing much has changed. The same steps and stairs, the same access to the river. Sitting on my boat hire step, watching everyone, particularly the youngsters, to see youngsters going out in boats, quite often with their grandparents. That's just a delight.
Hello, I'm Rosie. I am an artist and designer, and we are currently in a pop-up shop in Paved Court, right across the road from Ted Lasso's shop. It's the green. I had to come back to the green. The greenery is just beautiful, and being by the river is so gorgeous. If someone's new to Richmond, I think the White Cross pub, an absolute classic. Walking along the river, stunning. Richmond Park, you can't go wrong. Seeing deer in real life, I mean, that's just mad. It's so cool.
Hi, I'm Alex and I live in Richmond. I've lived here for about the last 3 years. I do love living here because it's got the combination of like all the lovely independent restaurants and coffee shops and things, but it's also got all the green space. We've got Richmond Green, go up to the park as well, and then we also live very near Kew Gardens, so it's just like got the perfect mix of everything. It's also really easy to get into places like London as well, like properly into London, because you've got all different train lines that run directly from here, so it's like a perfect combination of everything. And everyone here's super friendly as well.
My name's Rebecca. We moved to Richmond in 2019 and we love it because, look, our families are here, but it's such a wonderful place to be a family. We now have 3 kids, and being close to grandparents and nature and shops and culture and all the lovely things just makes it a fabulous place to be. We walk a lot. We love to walk along the river. We love to see, you know, the green up into Richmond Park. We popped into the library last week. We take our kids to the theatre here. Like, there's just lots and lots of things on, and a hop, skip and a jump to central London and all the things that are there.
My name's Dino. I'm a business owner and part-time football trader. My family have lived in Richmond for 50 years, so it's part of our heritage. We love the town because of the amenities, the green spaces around. We've got Kew Gardens on the doorstep. I went to see the orchids last week and they were beautiful. The people down our road are very friendly. Very lucky to live here, I think.
You certainly are. That was a quick look at Richmond, this year's winner for London in the Sunday Times Best Places to Live, sponsored by Lloyds. Now, Kevin, who's in Stroud, in answer to your question, is it Jane and Fee who actually come and fit the Wicks kitchen? If it is, then we'll take a new one. Ours must be almost a year old now.
Oh, well, right. Well, that's it.
It is.
High time.
I do the grouting. Jane does the first fix, and we're both very good with the U-bend.
Oh, God. I should say so. I tell you what, that mention of Kew Gardens, what do you think the queues were like in the tea rooms at Kew Gardens over the weekend?
Well, it was a very sprightly spring day in London.
You'd have waited hours for us gone.
Extremely happy.
Yeah.
And Kew at springtime must be absolutely beautiful with all the blossoms out. So, yes, I don't think there would have been a scone left after about 2:15.
I think you're probably right. It's Times Radio. It's 8 minutes to three.
Everything's computer.
A jury has found that Elon Musk defrauded Twitter investors when he tweeted that the social network had too many fake accounts in 2022. Jurors found that he intentionally misled Twitter shareholders in an effort to buy it for a lower price than his original bid of $44 billion. Right, come in, tech journalist Chris Stokel-Walker, our tech regular every single Monday. So two of the four fraud claims were knocked back. What were they exactly, Chris?
They were basically claims that the platform was not necessarily worth what it was in terms of some of the performance. So the one that was upheld and was seen as being worthwhile was this one about bots. The other one was other ones were basically about saying that actually the platform was poorly run and things like that, an attempt effectively to do down the company before he ended up taking it over. And of course, it is a significant moment at the minute that we are talking about Twitter, because it celebrated its 20th anniversary just this weekend, and has, under Elon Musk, gone in an unusual direction. So it is notable, I suppose, that this was the incident of actually there being issues with Elon Musk here, in terms of him using some slightly unusual tactics to try and convince people that he would be the right custodian for it, and everything that has gone on since perhaps suggests he maybe wasn't necessarily.
Right. Yes, you're the master of understatement, Chris. I do admire your way with words. So is he going to have to part with some dosh? And if so, how much? And where does it go?
Yeah, an awful lot of money, potentially. We don't quite know yet. That will be decided at a subsequent date. But the estimates are putting it anywhere between a few hundred million to billions of dollars, because he has materially affected the share price. And of course, at the time, Twitter was a publicly owned company, and that is really what I think is the issue here. Is it wasn't just that he was trying to do down the company's valuation so that he could get it for a song. He was effectively trying to do so at the expense of people who had bought shares in the firm at the time. So that is yet to be decided. I think that actually that might take a little bit of time, not least because Musk's lawyers, after this judgment, which came through just before the weekend, said that they were minded to appeal. And that's in part because generally Elon Musk likes to appeal these sorts of things, but also because he doesn't like to fall foul of anything that prevents him from posting on social media. So he's previously had an issue where he had misled investors in Tesla by saying that he was going to take the company private several years ago. It actually ended up with him having a court-mandated tweet watcher. So before he posted stuff on the website, he had to have it checked over by someone to ensure he didn't do the same thing again.
Let's talk about the BBC, which The Times is reporting today, will announce later on this week the name of the new Director General, and it's Matt Britton, who used to be a Google executive. Now, I can imagine that the BBC board think that this is a rather grand future-facing appointment that will have huge benefits for the organisation. Will it?
Yeah, I do think it will, actually, because Matt Britton was a very high-ranking executive at Google, actually. Annoyingly, Jane, he's one of those high flyers that does well at everything. He used to be, I think, an Olympic rower at one point in the 1980s. He's gone on to have different roles in various companies in a number of different industries, but managed to find himself overseeing Google in Europe and the Middle East and Africa for a number of years. He was there basically almost two decades, actually, and it turned out that he rose up the ranks, I think, for a reason, which was he was very good at the bit that, frankly, the next Director General of the BBC will have to be good at, which is liaising with governments, taking some of that flack, and then actually deflecting it and ensuring that rank-and-file employees are not affected. So he did incredibly well for Google when he was facing, for instance, select committees in Parliament. He was the public face of a number of tax disputes that Google had, and also just broader criticism about how the company operated in the region. Of course, Europe really quite strong on big tech. So, yeah, I think he's a mover and a shaker, and I think probably a good choice for the BBC, not just for forward-facing purposes, but also for acting as a little bit of a defensive shield.
OK, that's really interesting. I just wonder how, I don't know, if I were squirreling away somewhere in the bowels of Broadcasting House right now, fashioning a documentary about the loot for Radio 3, would I actually think this guy was going to do me any favours?
Well, probably not, but I guess we can talk till the cows come home about some of the issues of the BBC, and notably the fact that they have been relatively slow to adopt to new tech, and sometimes younger employees who have been trying to make their way up the ranks in terms of showing off their social media prowess and meeting the audience where it is halfway there. Sometimes they found it very difficult to get through. So I think they will be happy. Maybe not those who are working on Radio 3 documentaries. You're right, though, Jane.
Yeah, OK. But we wish him well. Right, let's talk about No, I do wish him well.
No, I wish him well, but I think the person we need to wish more well to is the person who's struggling to make a documentary about Alicia Radio 3. I mean, I'd just stop, mate. Just send out the tapes.
You know how it works in that building. You can be working on a documentary for 14 years and no one will query it.
I just don't want my money to go there.
I can't wait for Matt Britton to move in and find out what's going on in there. Right, let's talk about Luke Littler. He's the youngest darts world champion in history, and he's trademarking his face. And he's not the only one. Other people have done it. I can't believe that Cole Palmer has also trademarked the term Cold Palmer. Tell us more, Chris.
Yeah, I think you would very rarely see Cole Palmer, Matthew McConaughey and Luke Littler in the same sentence, except for now. Effectively, Littler is saying that he's going to trademark his face, his public persona, with the Intellectual Property Office in an attempt to head off anybody using it through AI. This is something that McConaughey used definitely before. Cole Palmer, I'm not really sure, needed to trademark the term Cold Palmer, but you know, some people might make memes like that.
Do you need to explain that it's his hilarious trademark shivery pose when he scores a goal?
Yes, hilarious is definitely one way to describe it, Jane. I'm a Newcastle fan, to be honest, and very gutted that we lost at the weekend to arch rival Sunderland. So Cole Palmer does nothing for me, I have to say.
And Sunderland have beaten you twice this season, haven't they? So
let's not talk about that.
Okay, all right.
It's the news night, isn't it? It's time for the top of the hour.
Yeah, it's all right, Chris. Right, goodbye. That is Chris Stokel-Walker. Apparently he's from Newcastle, I had no idea.
Well, I like his sense of timing.
It's very good. Now, what are we heading towards? The difficult time of 3 o'clock, when regular listener Glyn says it's too early to start the evening, but far too late to start anything constructive.
Yeah, it's a no man's land. So just stay with us. Just put everything else on pause. Yeah. Put your feet up, we're here for you.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
And it is now 3 o'clock. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio. In the next hour of our programme, the Times' policy editor will help us analyse what Keir Starmer's been saying about his foreign policy and the war in the Middle East. We're also going to hear about a golden 28 minutes for Britain's indoor athletes with Vassos in the sport. We'll open the doors of our literary salon after half past. And also, Adam Shaw is going to talk ISIS in Money Matters. All of that happens after the latest news headlines with Eliza Phillips.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. Donald Trump has suggested Iran may agree to give up plans for a nuclear weapons program in exchange for peace. Speaking to reporters from Florida, the US president insisted strong and productive talks had taken place, though that's being denied by Iranian media.
They called. I didn't call. They called. They want to make a deal. And we are very willing to make a deal. It's got to be a good deal. And it's got to be no more wars, no more nuclear weapons. They're not going to have nuclear weapons anymore. They're agreeing to that. Any of that stuff, there's no deal.
Well, he confirmed strikes on Iranian power plants have been postponed for 5 days. Oil prices have already fallen by as much as 13% in response to Donald Trump's announcement. The Prime Minister has welcomed talks between the US and Iran. He's appearing before the liaison committee. The session is focused on international affairs and the UK's defence strategy. Sir Keir Starmer was asked if households should be planning for disruption that lasts for months.
Hard to answer that question, if I'm honest about it. I think all of our focus and energy has to be in the swift de-escalation, but we've got to plan on the basis that it could go on for some time. And that's the way in which we'll plan this afternoon. And since the conflict started, I've been really clear with the team that we mustn't fall in to the sort of false comfort of thinking that there will necessarily be a quick and early end to this. We have to plan on the basis there may not be.
Police are searching for three suspects following an anti-Semitic arson attack on four Jewish volunteer ambulances in North London earlier this morning. No injuries have been reported. The city's mayor, Sadiq Khan, says there'll be additional police patrols in the area.
I'm in close contact with the police, including the commissioner, with the Community Security Trust, with local leaders, with the Jewish community, with the ambulance service, with the fire service, to make sure those responsible for this despicable, cowardly attack are brought to book with the full force of the law.
Two pilots have been killed after their passenger plane crashed on the runway at New York's LaGuardia Airport. The Air Canada jet collided with a fire truck, which had been called to another incident. And land on the outskirts of North London and a Bedfordshire village are among the chosen locations for new towns in England. Seven developments are planned, which ministers say will involve the building of up to 40,000 homes. They'll be designed to include things like schools, transport links and healthcare. Housing Minister Matthew Pennycook says they'll benefit the whole country.
Bringing forward large-scale new communities, whether they're standalone settlements or urban extensions, is a means of addressing the housing crisis, allowing people who are desperate to buy their first home or get an affordable home to rent to get that place where they can live securely and to unlock economic growth.
And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
We are going to celebrate some British sporting success in the company of Vassos Alexander in about 15 minutes' time. That was the golden half hour at the World Indoor Championships in Athletics in Poland over the weekend when all of a sudden we had a gold rush fee. Yes, we did.
We did, didn't we? Yes, I'm sorry. I've been slightly amused by Judith.
Yes.
And Judith won't be able to hear us. And,
no.
And you'll understand why if I read her message out. People in posh Tatton are too busy doing lunch, Pilates and golf to listen to Radio 5 Live. Nice. Well, they are. They're all listening to us, Judith. What are you doing?
Right. The idea of Donald Trump ever having a library is a bit silly, isn't it, says Dominic. Is he? I think Dominic's referring to the fact that after you've finished being president, you get to build a library and call it, name it after yourself. As Dominic points out, he has a vocabulary of about 60 words. Right, okay. I mean, I do think you and I quite often talk about his appalling use of the English language.
Well, I think today, when he's been saying we're going to carry on bombing our little hearts out, it's a trite phrase that
so
you might attach to something to do with it, you know, a kid's seventh birthday party.
Yeah.
It's not about the killing of an awful lot of people in the name of a cause you believe in. And it just seems to be ridiculously disrespectful, Jane.
Yeah.
And if, you know, there's no point in angering people in the world at the moment. They're angry enough.
Talking of which, Adam Shaw is with us at about 10 to 4.
Is he an angry man?
He's a lovely man. We're talking personal finance. I'm just talking about those people who are a little angry perhaps about the fate of their pensions or stocks and shares, ISA,
okay,
as we look out across the rather gloomy global picture
now. That's very true. Judith's not bothered, though.
She's fine. She's out there in tap.
Judith, you've got to change your number in your phone.
Living her best life.
Yep.
Right, let's go back to Westminster. And the Prime Minister is being grilled by MPs today on the foreign and defence policy of his government and his response to the conflict in the Middle East. Oliver Wright is the policy editor of The Times. Now, the Prime Minister says he knew about the talks that Donald Trump has referred to between the US and Iran.
My very strong view is we need to de-escalate and bring an end to this conflict as swiftly as possible. And we've been working with a number of countries in that regard. And to that end, I welcome the talks reported between the US and Iran. And to be clear with the committee, we, the UK, were aware that that was happening. And the immediate priority has to be a swift resolution of the conflict and delivering a negotiated agreement which puts tough conditions on Iran, particularly in relation to nuclear weapons.
Let's go to Oliver Wright, policy editor of The Times. What do you make of that, Oliver?
Struck me the most was a clip you played during the news where Starmer was asked, how long is this going to go on for? And watching him, you know, there's a look of sort of a perplexed look that comes over his face. He admits, you know, we really don't have any idea. And I think that's true. I was talking to someone in the Foreign Office this morning and spoke to them first at 10 o'clock and then spoke to them again at midday. And then everything had changed from a message that Trump had put out on social media, probably around sort of 5:30, 6 o'clock US time, all in capitals. And, you know, there is this sense that, you know, the information that London is getting, it's coming as much from social media as it is through sort of conventional diplomatic channels.
Yes. I mean, you do have to ask yourself, honestly, whatever you think of Keir Starmer, has there ever been a tougher time to be the British Prime Minister in terms of our relationship with our supposedly closest ally?
Yeah, I know. And it is something that is exercising people in Downing Street. You know, Starmer put a huge amount of effort at the start of his premiership into building a personal relationship with Donald Trump. But, you know, that has slightly come to naught as a consequence of all this. And, you know, one person who's been around for a while and was aware of Trump in his first term and says, you know, Trump falls out with everyone eventually. And, you know, that's where we find ourselves.
Let's hear the Prime Minister attempting to answer the question, one of the questions he's been posed at the liaison committee. He was asked just how long the current disruption could last.
Hard to answer that question, if I'm honest about it. I think all of our focus and energy has to be in the swift de-escalation, but we've got to plan on the basis that it could go on for some time. And that's the way in which we'll plan this afternoon. And since the conflict started, I've been really clear with the team that we mustn't fall in to the sort of false comfort of thinking that there will necessarily be a quick and early end to this. We have to plan on the basis there may not be.
Well, that's it in a nutshell. As you were saying, Oliver, he doesn't know.
Yeah, don't rely on taco. Trump always chickens out. Might be the occasion that he doesn't. Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. And, yeah, particularly that's true in terms of something like energy prices. You know, energy bills are due to fall in April, but, you know, in June they could rise very significantly. Now, ministers take the view that if this conflict is reasonably temporary, then they should fall again by winter. But what if they don't? So in a way, the government is having to make decisions now with a blindfold on because it doesn't actually know where things are going to go and just how long this disruption will last and what its impact will be on things like energy bills and oil prices.
Right. OK, let's hear the Prime Minister talking about the price of energy. And he is attempting to offer a bit of comfort here.
Energy has been where a huge amount of focus has been. On energy supplies, I can reassure the committee that we haven't any meaningful concerns about energy supplies. Obviously, the price fluctuates daily. For household energy bills, it is important for me to reiterate that they will be cut because of the measures we took in the budget last year and then held until the end of June. And I know that for many members of the public, the question they've been asking is, does that still hold even if the conflict goes on? And the answer to that question is yes. Mm. So there's comfort there for households. Obviously, fuel duty is held until September.
Right. Let's move on. Iran's capacity to launch missiles at far-flung targets very much in the news over the weekend after it attempted to attack the US and British base in Diego Garcia. Now, the Prime Minister was questioned on the UK's lack of air defences. For example, we've heard a lot recently about Israel's Iron Dome. The man asking the question is Tan Desi, who is the chair of the Defence Select Committee.
The British public will rightly be concerned about our own safety because forget a Golden Dome or a Platinum Dome or any other dome, we have not made any such investments in our own defence. And would you not agree that the public will be concerned about the ability of Russia or another adversary to launch ballistic missiles and we have no way of defending ourselves?
Yeah, look, we constantly assess this and we do have very effective ways of defending ourselves. And I don't want to raise levels of public anxiety. They're anxious about what they're already seeing on their television screens. They're anxious about the impact it will have on them, particularly economically, in their households. And I don't want to raise their levels of anxiety. I can tell you our military personnel, our security and intelligence services are working literally 24/7 to keep us safe and doing a very good job.
Yeah, I mean, that was real flannel, that, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I was struck listening to that with a conversation I had with John Healey when Labour were in opposition. And it was something that he identified that really, you know, unlike a number of other countries, there is no missile defence shield that the UK has. Its capabilities is extremely limited. And I thought Starmer, frankly, just didn't answer that question and just sort of, you know, people are looking at this, don't worry, it's all right, trust us. But, you know, it's not that plausible.
Right. Okay. The Prime Minister was asked another question. Would we finally see the defence investment plan? Now, this is something the defence industry is desperate for.
Well, we're working hard to finalise it. I know from the work your committee does, you'll be aware this has been the first zero-based review that has ever been undertaken, so it's a huge amount of work. We're finalising it. We've absolutely got to get it right. And I want to ensure that anything relevant from this conflict is included within it. But we're finalising it. I can't give you a date, but I can tell you we're finalising it.
So why isn't there a defence investment plan? What's the hold-up, Oliver?
Money, in a single word. In order to have a defence investment plan, you need to know how much money you've got to put into that defence investment plan. Now, of course, the government has announced proposals to increase the amount of money that the UK puts each year into defence to 2.8%. In the longer term, they promised to hit 3.5% by 2035, but there is no pathway to doing that. And I thought Starmer's answers on this were really quite interesting. And reading between the lines, I think what he is saying is we need to announce what extra money we are putting into defence at the same time as we announce the defence investment programme. So I think, you know, we could actually get a announcement in the coming months of just how and when the government is going to increase overall defence budgets at the same time as that defence investment plan. But I think that is the hold-up.
Right. And presumably this will have to be sold to the public, because maybe at some point we're going to have to accept the possibility of paying more in tax in order to be better defended.
Yeah. I think that's right. And I don't think anyone has really started talking about those trade-offs, but it's really obvious. You know, listeners know the state of public finances, you know, the pressures on public services. And if you suddenly want to find, you know, an extra 30, 40 billion pounds here, you know, you just simply cannot do that within existing budgets. So the government is going to have to start making the case for saying, you know, if we want to be properly defended, we need to pay for that defence. And the only way we can really pay for that defence is through higher taxes. So, yeah, I think you may get an element of that. And I do think when they announce the plan for increasing defence spending, they are also going to have to identify exactly how they're going to pay for it.
Right. Sophie has a question. Does any other Western European country have such a defensive dome? Is there much point as we're all so close together? I suppose I could also lob in the question, could we have a European defence dome of some sort at some future date?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly something that people have been talking about. And other countries do have better levels of defence than we do. I think the view has always been that we're sort of, to use a dreadful phrase, further from the action than others, you know, that we're a bit distant from it, therefore we don't need it because others do. I'm not sure that assumption holds in the world in which we live in today. But, you know, having a sort of a European defensive dome, which has, as I say, been talked about, you know, then the question is, well, should it be European? Should it be NATO? What's the command and control structure? It suddenly gets really complicated quite quickly. But yeah, no, it is absolutely something that's being talked about.
Now, I did hear Andrew Neil on Times Radio Breakfast this morning, and he was very sceptical, wonderfully sceptical, I might say, about COBRA. Do you share his misgivings? Because it does sound very butch and proactive. But what actually goes on at a COBRA meeting?
A COBRA meeting is basically a sort of way of signalling the government, we're taking this very seriously. Look, you absolutely need those kind of meetings. That's exactly what government needs to be doing. You know, the fact that you call it COBRA and people sort of understand what it means, it's a sort of, you're sending a signal to the country, to voters, yeah, this is a problem, we're taking it seriously, rather than saying, oh yeah, we've just got another cabinet committee meeting going on. But, you know, I think it is slightly performative, but yeah, you know, the point about it is you bring the people from a range of different sectors, range of different interests, you know, whether that be politicians, civil servants, in this case, you know, the governor of the Bank of England, you bring them into one room and you use it as a coordination mechanism. But no, it's slightly, you know, it's slightly oversold, I think.
Okay. And as we speak at the moment, and I appreciate things could change in the next 10 minutes, at 17 minutes past three, there's moderate optimism about the possibility of the Middle East crisis slightly calming down over the next couple of days?
Yeah, I think that's fair at 17 minutes past three. But, you know, it was not that long ago since Donald Trump said, you know, we've got 48 hours or we're going to start bombing Israeli energy infrastructure. So, you know, yeah, things can change. But I suppose if you wanted to make the case for optimism, you know, the view has always been that Donald Trump needs an off-ramp. And, you know, his statements today suggest that he is building one. And, you know, let's see. But I think, you know, I think there are grounds for sort of moderate optimism. I wouldn't go much further than that.
OK, well, we'll take it. We'll take anything, quite frankly. thank you very much for talking to us. We appreciate it. That is Oliver Wright, who is the Times policy editor.
I mean, the problem is that everybody needs an off-ramp, don't they? And they can't all build one and for it to head in the same direction. And Cobra isn't really Cobra, is it? The A on the end has just been added to make it easier for us to say because it's Cobra. It's Cabinet Office Briefing Room.
Who is it?
Cobra.
Yeah. Well, why don't we just start being completely honest and say... There's a Cobra meeting.
Yeah. It's like all of those tech companies that just dropped the vowels. And do you remember some financial companies as well? Aberdeen became Aberdeen. And we've tried actually on our podcast to simply become Glvgov. Didn't catch on.
God knows why not. Right.
Coming up, we're going to discuss... Well, I'm glad you asked. It's 19 minutes past three. Coming up, we're going to discuss the superwomen who brought Britain three golds in less than half an hour. 28 minutes, to be precise. All of that with Vassos, the sport. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
John Pienaar on Times Radio, telling the stories that matter.
We're talking about nothing less than the definition and redefinition of America. That's not overstating.
Expert analysis and well-informed discussion.
If there is violence, and these fans are known for it, well, someone is going to have to answer for that afterwards.
And diverse opinion.
I guess I can understand the intentions behind this, but I've never quite been able to understand why the police had to be involved at all.
John Pienaar at Drive, this afternoon from 4 on Times Radio.
Stop it.
At QuickFit, our customers drive away happy every time.
Get off.
Do we tickle their feet? No.
Oh, all right.
We just do our job, like having an excellent range of tyres to suit every car on the road.
Oh, that's good to know.
That's why our customers drive away happy. Quick Fit. Drive away happy every time.
This was made with human intelligence.
And artificial intelligence.
Just like Intuit QuickBooks business management software. If you're a sole trader earning over 50K from April 2026, making tax digital means...
you have to file your taxes online.
But new QuickBooks AI has...
automated tools to help make compliance easier.
I was going to say that. I'll do it with Intuit QuickBooks.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens, helping create kitchens to feel proud of. From expert design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Learn more at wix.co.uk.
Move over, Super Saturday. We have just witnessed the golden half hour at the World Indoor Championships in Poland. A trio of Britain's most elite sportswomen pulled off a feast, a feat even faster than the legends of London 2012. It was a 28-minute blitz. Georgia Bell, Molly Cowdrey, Keely Hodgkinson all secured world titles, earning three gold medals in less than half an hour. Let's talk about all of that with Vassos Alexander, who joins us every day. Can we talk about Keely Hodgkinson, first of all? I mean, she is just quite extraordinary, isn't she?
I think she might be the dominant athlete in the world in any event.
Do you really?
Man or woman, okay. You know, you looked at her on the start line. Actually, she looked a little nervous on the start line, and she doesn't normally. She sort of looks a little bit supercilious, like, I've got this. But I think I must have misread her expression on the start line, because it was a thoroughly dominant display. And she knows she's better than everybody else in the world. A couple of weeks ago, she broke the 800 metres world record indoors, and she just... I'm just like, you know, you look at people and you think, what are you talking about, Luke Littler? At his best, Luke Littler is a better darts player than anyone else on the planet currently, but Keely Hodgkinson is that plus plus, you know, because darts is a lot in the mind, an 800 metres race is a lot in the mind, but she's just got the speed as well. She's got the racecraft and she's got the speed. They're calling her in her training camp at the moment Keely 2.0, because she did go through, so she won the Olympic gold in Paris and then she didn't race for over a year after that because of injury.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
And then she's come back. She's won world championships. I mean, she's ace, and she is just on a different. I think she will be, if she stays injury free and touch wood, our greatest ever athlete.
Wow. How old is she now?
She is 24 years old. So she was born in March 2002. Yeah. So she absolutely could. She could dominate for 10 years. So Kelly Holmes was, when she won gold in the 800 metres and 1500 metres in Athens, we were there, weren't we, Jane? Mm-hmm. She was 34 when she did that. So that was towards the end of her career. And she'd had a load of near misses and unlucky stories through injury. Mm. But she was, you know, 34 is absolutely still doable to be winning Olympic gold medals. And Keely's already got one, and she's only 24.
And she did this extraordinary thing, didn't she, where she went out for the 800 metre, and then less than 60 minutes later, she's back on the track. How do you train a body to have that kind of recovery? Because, you know, the 800 metres is punishing. On your legs, it must be punishing.
Yeah, It is. It's a really hard event, especially the way she runs it from the front. Like, catch me if you can. Oh, you can't again. And then she did a little bit of celebration, the three gold medalists, the flags and all of that. But then she went straight to the warm-up track because it was the 4x400-metre relay. And she thought, well, I'll help out the team. And actually, she anchored the team. And listen to this, right? So she's just won the 800 metres, and she's an 800-metre runner in one of the fastest times of all time indoors, right? Then she comes, like you say, less than an hour later to anchor the British leg in the relay. Britain were nowhere by the time she got the baton, so she's not running for a medal. But of everybody in that 4x400, not just Britain's, everybody in that 4x400-metre relay, she ran the quickest flipping leg. She is just extraordinary. Mo Farah used to do this. He'd like, it would be a slightly sort of minor meeting at Crystal Palace or something, and he'd run the 5,000 metres, and then his coach would go, right, now let's run a hard interval session or something later that evening when everyone had gone home, just to sort of train the body to do that sort of thing, to be surprised by what's coming up. So she will have, you know, she trains hard. She'll be able to do it. And adrenaline does amazing things.
Yeah, I hope her hips survive. Oh, I always worry about that.
Rob says the most dominant athlete is surely Duplantis.
Oh,
is
he, yes. The, no, he is the pole vaulter.
Yeah.
He is the pole vaulter, and he is pretty unbeatable as well. So he does this great thing. So he has, I don't know what he's got, but he knows he's got quite a lot more in him, but he breaks the world record by half a centimetre. He thinks, well, what's the prize for breaking a world record at this? Oh, it's £100,000, is it? Okay, I think I might break the world record by a centimetre today. Mm-hmm. And then next week, is it? Oh, it's 100 grand again. Yeah, I'll
take the money.
I'll take the money, go around the world.
Can I ask a daft question? Are times faster or slower indoors?
They are slower indoors.
Are they? Why?
I don't know. Okay. And I might be wrong, but I don't think I am.
Okay.
Maybe there's some kind of breeze
wind.
That helps.
Is it the wind?
Well, wind does often help. Better route than in. Let's stick with the women, if we can, please. Georgia Bell, 2 years ago, she was working in tech sales. She's now a world champion with a British record. Well, I mean, there's nothing wrong with tech sales. It's good to just be a young person, have a job at the moment, Vassos. But, you know, to have a full-time job and to be putting in the training that then takes you to become a world champion is really, really worth celebrating.
She's a great story. Georgia Hunter Bell, as she's called now, Olympic bronze medalist whilst working in cybersecurity. She was like flogging cybersecurity. Do you want this, you know, VPN or whatever? And she won the Olympic bronze, but she'd taken 5 years away from the sport. Her body basically just broke down. She got a scholarship. She was training in the USA and she just couldn't take all the training. So she got some degrees and she got a really good job. And she was training. And then during the pandemic, she sort of rediscovered the love of running. Turned up to Bushey Park, which is the home of Park Run, that free 5K timed run everywhere in the country, really. And she sort of smashed it out the park and then did it again. And she could see her PB getting quicker and quicker and quicker and thought, well, I wonder if I should return to athletics. Did, won an Olympic bronze medal in 2024 and is now the world champion in the 1500 metres, her first global title. She's 32, but she trains with Keely Hodgkinson. And it, I mean, they're great friends as well. And it's just brilliant to see. A great story, as, by the way, is Molly Cawdrey, the 26-year-old pole vaulter from Cornwall, who just had an absolute nightmare with injuries and you know, in the Paris Olympics, she came in too high and she just didn't register a qualification jump. So she was one of the favourites for gold and had to go, you know, home with the tail between her legs, heartbroken, she said in the interviews. And, when these athletes, they aim for these days, you've got to perform today, and then you don't, and then you get asked about it on national television, and you could see, you know, tears in her eyes, heartbroken. And then the Tokyo World Championships last year, she's just going for a warm-up jump, twists her ankle just in a freak accident, has to leave again in tears, all of her competitors giving her a hug on the mat where she's, you know, where she's clearly in pain and not able to continue. She gets wheeled away in a wheelchair. She was still unable to jump in January. And then comes back to her, you know, her comeback championships and wins the gold medal. Absolutely fantastic. And actually, Jessica Ennis-Hill, who was part of the BBC team covering it from Salford, I think, she said it's great for young girls to see this trio of British women doing so brilliantly at the gold on the global scale. And I watched that happen in real time. I was watching this with our 11-year-old, Mary, who was watching this, and she said, this is just great. And you could just see the spark happening inside her, like, oh, look what they're doing. And I can see the role model on the TV in front of me. It was fantastic to watch.
I think it is superb. And obviously, there's something else that's involved in women's athletics, which is actually seeing really incredible, very strong, fit female bodies, which I think at the moment really needs to be celebrated, Vassos, because there's a different conversation going on about young female bodies on Instagram, which is all about thin and it's all about disappearing yourself. But these three women just look so fabulous with their strength and their fitness. I absolutely agree with you. It's a way to turn heads in the right direction. So many people want to point out the difference between indoor and outdoor. Helen, Martin, Rob, God, this is like an eye test. it really is. And a nameless person. The times are slower because they run more curves because the track is shorter.
Yeah, well, obviously, because it's a 200-metre track and it's banked rather than a 400-metre track, which is outdoors. But I didn't know that you slowed down so much on the curves, so thank you, all of those people.
Yes. Athletes can't run as quickly around the tight corners. That one was from Rob. Times are slower indoors because the track is small, shorter, and the corners are tighter. Thank
Good
you, everybody.
Good knowledge, the listeners of Times Radio.
That a corner can have such an impact.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know,
they're not actually tight to the corners.
No.
I mean, you know, I would think I would be sprinting round them.
Have you seen Fee walk? She is the quickest. No, she's the quickest walker. Honestly, it's incredible. There's just no point. Sometimes we leave the building at the same time, but there's no point in us giving each other the benefit of the other's company while we get to the tube because I'm just left.
It's because I've got a lower centre of gravity. I just move at speed. Do you do park runs, Vassos?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've loads. In fact, I used to host a park run podcast. I love park run. It is fantastic. And the thing that they do best, I think, that one of those like genius ideas, well, it's a genius idea anyway, right? But they came up with, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, the idea of a tail runner or a tail walker. So you can't come last, which is such a big barrier to people turning up to an event. You think, what if everyone laughs at me? What if I'm last? Well, you can't be, because there's a tail walker.
Oh, that's brilliant.
And it's just fantastic. So people, if you're thinking about, you know, and also, here's this thing, you go to parkrun and it's such a welcoming, happy, it's as much about the community as it is about the run.
Yeah.
And the volunteers, and it's a lovely, wonderful thing, and it's 100% free.
Brilliant.
Well, we really must sign up.
Yes, we must.
Yes, we must.
Thank you, Vassal. See you tomorrow.
Shuffles papers, looks the other way.
We'll open the doors next to our Monday Literary Salon. This week we're going to be joined by Susie Goldsborough, Deputy Literary Editor of The Times. Right, it's 3:32. Good afternoon. Here are the latest news headlines. Eliza Phillips.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thanks, Jane. Good afternoon. The US president's claiming oil prices will drop like a rock as soon as a deal's made with Iran. Costs have risen, with tankers effectively blocked in a key shipping route as a result of the war in the Middle East. But they fell sharply in response to Donald Trump postponing strikes on Iranian power plants following productive talks. Keir Starmer's reiterated household energy bills will be cut and then held until the end of June, even if the conflict in Iran continues. Counter-terrorism police are looking into the legitimacy of a group claiming responsibility online for an arson attack on four Jewish community ambulances in North London. It's being treated as an anti-Semitic hate crime. There have been no arrests as of yet. Nicole Lampert is a journalist. She says the Hatzola Ambulance Service treats anyone.
The ambulance service will phone them and say, we've got this going on in your area, can you pick them up? So Jewish people or anyone can phone them directly, but also the ambulance service will say, there's just someone in the area that you work in. So my father, a few years ago, he had a fall and we called the ambulance service and they said it'll be a few hours. My aunt said, try Hatzola, and someone came over in 5 minutes and he was taken by ambulance to hospital.
HS2 high-speed railway trains could be made to run slower than planned. The idea is to reduce costs. And the former BBC newsreader Hugh Edwards has complained that a TV drama depicting his fall from grace made no attempt to check the truth with him. He says the show, which airs on Tuesday, seems irresponsible, unfair and not up to broadcasting standards. He says he intends to make his own account of events. For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we have been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the great rivers, then on all five oceans, now on all seven continents. We are One Viking, exploring the world in comfort.
Get the day's politics, business and sport every weekday in Breakfast from 6:30 a.m. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. Choose from over 80 kitchen styles. Whether it's your first home or your forever home, find your dream kitchen at Wix. Prices start from under £3,000. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Now, sprinting through the French windows to join us for our literary salon this Monday is Susie Goldsborough, who's also added herself as a runner as well.
A slow one.
Well, you say that. You are Deputy Literary Editor of The Times and The Sunday Times. So, Vassos, what time did Vassos claim for his park run?
So, his fastest ever was around 18 minutes.
Okay. What would you do it in?
I always want to say double that. No, oh. I'd probably run it in about half an hour, okay. 25 minutes, something,
Look,
something
we're,
more
we are not
leisurely.
Going to judge you.
I feel very defensive somehow.
But you really, not in our company, you don't need to be defensive about this.
Thank you.
Right, I think that's a very, very good effort. And I've never done it. Have you done it?
No, me and running don't. We haven't really met as friends for a very long time.
No, I just go vaguely and my knees, and I don't do it. Right, what recommendations have you got for us this week? Now, in fact, one of the books you're about to discuss, I've ordered on the strength of your recommendation. Ooh. Already. I'm so excited to read it. Let's start, though, with something I haven't ordered. A Vast Horizon by Anna Thomason.
I was worried you were going to say you'd ordered that one.
Don't worry.
An anti-recommendation. No, so this is a new group biography that I reviewed last weekend, which has a kind of brilliant topic. It's about an artist's holiday that took place in the south of France in 1937, where a bunch of kind of surrealists and writers and dancers all went on holiday together. Lee Miller, subject of that great tape retrospective that lots of people have seen, I think, and Pablo Picasso, Man Ray, all sorts of people. And they took amazing photographs of each other kind of draped in their bikinis on the beach. So I was sort of hoping for a kind of sun-soaked last hurrah before the war, bohemian, you know, kind of like early summer read, but it was a slightly turgid book and sort of oddly sinister, but a great subject. And I really like that Lee Miller show.
Right, yes. And the film that Kate Winslet made. Yeah, because we interviewed Lee Miller's daughter, son, didn't we?
Well, we did. Yes. And actually, exactly that part of Lee Miller's life is rather beautifully captured in the film. And they do make it seem like a kind of evocative last hurrah for all of the artists. I remember that part in particular.
What boggles my mind is, with a gathering like that, I mean, who did the logistics? Who actually...
Who was booking the Airbnb?
Yeah, all of that. Who worked out the meal plan?
Yeah, exactly. Who's Anne on planning?
Yes,
out of those
who is
people?
It?
My guess would be it was Lee Miller's lover, Roland Penrose, because there was a lovely picture of him in the show when he had mumps all sort of tucked up in bed. And he seemed like quite a kind of, responsible chap. And during the war, he turned his painting into camouflage, and he became a master camouflager and worked for the British Army. So he seemed like someone quite capable.
Yeah,
so I see him on logistics, yeah.
Okay, but it's interesting that you just found the whole thing, what, not just a bit, what, navel-gazing twaddle? What was it?
It was just... It was written in quite a dull way, and it didn't use any primary sources. That was the real problem for me, because all of these people wrote compulsively, and you know, their diaries and letters, and you want to hear their kind of, you want to hear their voices. But this was just, everything was just kind of her describing it in a sort of oddly dry manner. So there are better ways of discovering these people, I think.
Yes. Okay. Well, actually, you could do worse than to watch that film with Kate Winslet.
Totally. Yeah, and, she's great.
Yeah, and the Tate Show has closed, I think.
It has, unfortunately, but it was so brilliant. Did you guys see it?
I didn't, actually.
Yes, I did.
You did, yeah. What did you think?
I thought it was just amazing. I can't quite believe that Lee Miller hasn't had a bigger place in our national consciousness before the film and the retrospective. Yeah. And I think hugely respected and admired in the photography world, but not so much. Mm. I don't think... her name tripped off enough tongues, actually, in her lifetime. No. I think her photography is just extraordinary.
Yeah. And her concentration camp pictures were published by American Vogue. That's what boggles my mind.
Yeah.
Vogue comes out of that very well.
I thought that in the film. Yes, absolutely remarkable. Because I've not been a huge Vogue reader over the years. And in fact, that was a real education. I didn't know that. Okay, now to the book I have ordered, which is Austerity Britain by David Kynaston. And I've seen it. Is it being republished? Is that why there's suddenly a fuss?
No, sorry, I'm bringing this up with absolutely no context.
I love you for it. Carry on.
I'm trying to read more non-fiction and kind of fill in my 20th century knowledge gaps. But it was a big, big book when it came out in 2007, I think. And I believe the Sunday Times named it a book of the decade. So it feels like it should be part of my job description to catch up on it anyway. It's just brilliant social history. He's so good at, you know, obviously all the kind of key post-war figures are in it, Clement Attlee, Nye Bevan. But he's really, I think, interested in just the ordinary person. And I think a lot of the sources he uses is the thing called the mass observation study, which is that kind of long-running study of ordinary people in Britain. So the voices you have in it of the Welsh coal miner, the Tottenham single mother doing the shopping, it really gives you a flavour of this Britain that, you know, I'd never otherwise be able to access. So I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, whenever you mention or anybody mentions mass observation, I always think about that Victoria Wood film that she made. What was it called? Housewife
49.
Housewife 49.
Oh, I don't know this.
Oh, it's one of Victoria Wood's sort of not, how would you describe it, side projects, I guess. It was a film, wasn't it? It was about an hour and a half, and she played a woman called Nella Last.
Oh, she figures in the book.
Does
she?
Okay.
Yeah.
From memory, I think she might have been Cumbrian.
Oh, okay.
I don't know, but it was just about your average World War II housewife, that was all mass observation, and it was absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
I did read up a little bit about the book, and there's a great anecdote because it begins this book on VE Day when officially it was all over. Mm. And there's a cracking story about a chambermaid who went to a pub in Islington with a Nazi flag that she'd got from somewhere, and she charged people to spit on it. Isn't that great? And she made a bit of money, and she went home happy.
That's a natural entrepreneur. She'd be in the tech industry today.
Yeah, I mean, I also though do know that on VE Day, you know, obviously, I may as well say it, I wasn't alive. but not everybody was happy. I mean, if your son had been killed 2 weeks before, you had absolutely nothing to celebrate.
Yeah.
It must have been so awful.
Yeah. And I remember in that chapter where he talks about it, lots of people did seem to have a sense, if not of sadness, then of anticlimax, this kind of general exhaustion, and no one was really in a party mood necessarily. I mean, some people were, but yeah, no, it wasn't straightforwardly a happy moment, was it?
No, I'm sure it wasn't for so, so many people. But I gather this book is not only really interesting, but brilliantly written.
Oh, not to be too rude about the, but in contrast to the last one, he's just such a kind of naturally entertaining writer. Everything's put lucidly with a little joke or a little elegant touch, and it's just never dry, which is hard for this sort of book, I think.
Yeah, well, it sounds a really solid recommendation. That is Austerity Britain by David Kynaston, and trust me, you can get it because I have. Right, now let's be moved to poetry in the company of Frank O'Hara. Lunch poems.
I had a change of heart about this one. Can I change it on the spot?
Yeah.
Because I thought we should have something a bit more, I don't know, a little bit more fun. So another book I just read was called Death Goes on Skis by Nancy Spain, which is from 1949, because I am very embarrassed, but I went skiing, but I thought I should take a good, I should take an appropriate choice with me.
Why are you embarrassed to have gone skiing?
It's
Times Radio, darling. We'll be fine. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, if I'm doing my chippy northerner thing, I will judge you. But Fee probably would.
I'm looking for laceration. No, it was good fun. But this is a brilliant 50s whodunit set in a fictional European ski resort. And I'm just, you know, I just drink in all that stuff, any kind of Agatha Christie or Dorothy L. Sayers. And Nancy Spain is slightly less well known, but I've been reading up on her and she's a fascinating figure. She was Mrs. Beaton's great niece, and she was actually sadly killed in a plane crash on the way to the Grand National in the 1960s. And when she died, her great friend Noel Coward wrote that it is cruel that all gaiety, intelligence and vitality should be snuffed out when so many bores and horrors remain. Which, wow, I really liked.
How are you spelling Spain?
Like the country.
Okay, right, thank you. Nancy Spain, and the book is called?
Death Goes on Skis.
And we've just packed up with Frank O'Hara's lunch poems. We're just
Those are great too. We can talk about those too.
Very briefly then, what is Lunch Poems?
It's a collection that Frank O'Hara, whose centenary is this year, you know, the great American poet, wrote on his lunch breaks when he was a curator at MoMA. And they are just some of the easiest, most pleasurable poetry to read, I think. You know, idiomatic, flowing, sweet, funny. And I know it's a hard thing to get to kind of feel motivated to pick up a book of poetry, but Frank O'Hara to me is a joy.
Yeah, okay. I mean, what sort of things does he write about?
Do you know the poem Having a Coke with You?
No.
He writes about walking through New York and looking at the pigeons and feeling full of love for the person at home he's thinking about. But it's not sentimental. It's sort of genuine without being sickly or sentimental because he's such a good writer. Having a Coke with You is just about the joy of having a Coke with someone you're in love with. So I find them very lovely.
Okay, well, that's very sweet. Well, I think I'll mull over your decision to go skiing. We'll see whether or not you're allowed back. Thank you very much. Good to have you, Susie. Thank you very much indeed. And Fee, you've got a big literary guest tomorrow.
Well, we both have, because David Soleil is going to be our guest in the studio.
Oh, wow.
Exactly. Talking about Flesh. It won the Booker Prize last year. It is a remarkable book. There's just so much to talk about with it because it is about the male gaze. But actually, throughout the book, the women are largely in control of the gaze that's being asked to be directed at them. So you might go into it thinking, oh, this is going to be a book from a male perspective that maybe is a bit difficult to read, but it's not at all. It's really empathetic and compassionate. Mm. And there's a lot to say. What would you like to ask him? And I'll put the question to him.
Well, I just always wanted to know how to pronounce his name, but I've learned it now. So you don't need to ask him that.
Okay.
I really like that book. So very interested to listen to that.
Yes. So he is our guest tomorrow afternoon. And anybody else who's read it and wants to chuck in a question,
just, you know, make the most of the fact that he'll be here live, because quite often our guests are pre-recorded just because of the way that we rumble and they rumble. Mm. So it's a rare treat to have him live in the studio. And I think also somebody who writes so wisely about a man's journey through life just must have quite a lot to tell us at the moment about what we can do about the manosphere and the terrible things that are going on. And,
you know,
he's a really, really clever man, and he's got a very... He's got a very gentle turn of phrase about some of the kind of most brutal aspects of gender. So it'll be fascinating to talk to him.
He's not British. Is he British?
No. No. So I don't know where Soleil comes from as a name. You've asked me one of those questions.
Oh, sorry.
I can't answer. I'll look it up.
as this year's book winner, guys.
Yes.
I should know.
Right. Well, I've put her in it there.
I
do apologise.
I suppose
last thing I wanted to do.
The many, many gaps.
It's Times Radio. Susie, thank you very much. We'll see you soon, I'm sure.
Thank
Who's
you.
Next for you? It's only our money, man.
It is. It's Adam Shaw. I can answer that question. It's Adam Shaw. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk. Could you look it up?
The Evening Edition with Kate Borsay on Times Radio. Hosting an honest conversation about current affairs, well-being, lifestyle, health and wealth. Plus, don't miss Tomorrow's Home, highlighting how you can make your house more energy efficient. The Evening Edition with Kate Borsay. Tonight from 7 on Times Radio. With the UK government's boiler upgrade scheme. You could upgrade your heating with a £7,500 heat pump grant. Visit gov.uk/cleanenergy to check eligibility.
Coming soon, rowing's greatest rivalry, live and exclusively on Times Radio.
In a world of noise and uncertainty, IG is the investment platform that backs you. Take our flexible stocks ISA, which gives you the freedom to withdraw funds anytime and replace them in the same tax year, all without losing your £20,000 tax-free allowance. And if that's not enough, pay no commission on your stocks, shares and ETFs when you invest with IG. IG. Trade. Invest. Progress. Your capital's at risk. Other fees may apply. Tax treatment depends on individual circumstances and is subject to change.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Thanks so much.
Canadian is the answer to where David Soleil originally hails from. Hello, Adam Shaw. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you very much.
Okay, we sometimes wonder what you walked into.
Yes.
Yeah, you're not the only one. Don't worry about it.
We do all the time. Apparently people are listening to it as well. Tell your friends. Now, we really do need to talk to you every week at the moment, because the big geopolitical chaos out there is having real life implications for people, isn't it? Stock markets have fallen heavily today amidst rising concerns about the war in Iran and the effect it's going to have on global economy. The falls coincide with the end of the tax year, when investors often use up their ISA allowance for tax-free stock market investments. And it does make the decision about what to do even more complex.
Yeah.
So, where should we start? How worried should we all be?
Yes, we should be worried, but not overly so. I mean, I always feel difficult talking about this because, as you quite rightly say, this is real money. This is people's life savings. It happens in a context where other people are dying. So in the grand scheme of things, how important is an ISA when we're seeing a large amount of people dying in this war?
I'm glad you said that. Sometimes we do need to bear that in mind.
So it's not unimportant. It is important because this is a real thing that affects people really here. But also, it's part of a terrible wider thing, and it's important for us to recognise that. The straightforward answer to your question, however, I think, you know, given you've just come off talking about the literary world, there's a thing here. I think it is the best of charts, it is the worst of charts. If you look at what's happened in the past week or so, there's good cause for very serious concern. Share prices have fallen. That means your investments, your pensions, your ISA are all down. If you look over the past year, however, even given the fall we've seen, we're up. And indeed, if you look at the headlines, words like crises, I don't think are quite applicable now. If you compare them to the 1987 crash, we saw shares fall about 30%. The dot-com crash, they fell about 47%. The financial crisis of 2008, down 40%. COVID, we're down 30%. We're not in this territory. The only thing I'd say about that is that it took years for those markets to rise back to their previous level. If we see a fall anything like that, you are probably waiting years to gain back. But it underlines the fundamental truth about stock market investments. It is a long-term thing. If you want your money back in a year or so, I don't think this is the place for you.
But it goes against what our current Chancellor has been trying to get us to embrace, which is a mindset of the investor. And it couldn't be a worse time to be telling people to put their life savings into the stock market.
Yes, no, look, well, I don't know. It depends on your... You could... People do argue it's a great time to put your money into the stock market, because what often happens to amateur investors or small-scale investors is they buy when everyone's very excited, and as a result, they're the most expensive times to buy, and they're very scared when the market falls, so sell or don't buy, and that's actually the cheapest time to buy. So there is an argument to go, if you've got the money and you're not, you can afford to lose it and you can afford to wait, now is actually something of an opportunity. So there is that argument. But to your political point, the thing is very well made. This government is pushing people towards investing in the stock market. In a year's time, your cash ISA allowance will have shrunk dramatically. The only place to put it in is in shares. And therefore, this government is pushing investors, small-scale investors, towards risky investments.
So remind us of what the actual figures are now. So you still have £20,000 that you can put in tax-free, but you can't put it all...
Yeah, you can at the moment. And especially given what we were talking about, the volatility of the stock market, if you can't afford to lose money, you need it quickly, or you're risk-averse, now might be a time to max out on your cash ISA when you can put it all into a cash ISA. There are about 8 million people in the UK who haven't taken up their ISA allowance. So there's lots of people who are investing but haven't quite thought, oh, I could max it out. That would be a good opportunity to do that. If you're looking at fixed rate investments, you can get a good, well over 4% fixed rate. So Close Brothers, I mean, I won't go through the numbers, but these are all over 4%. Have a five-year fix for 4%. Investec, a one-year fix over 4%. Skipton Building Society, lots of people like going with a building society. They do over 4%. You can get more or less the same on variable cash ISAs. So the rate will rise and fall. And I've listed them on socials if that's what interests you. You can also, I'd recommend a website called moneyfactscompare.co.uk. You can see all the latest prices there. But yes.
And then what then changes after the end of this year?
You can then only put, so at the moment you could put all £20,000 into the cash ISA. From April 2027, you'll only be able to put £12,000 in a cash ISA. If you are under the age of 65, there is an opt out. If you are over the age of 65, you can still put money in cash. And the reason I think behind that is because, you know, sounds terrible, but you have less time to wait for the market to rebound.
Break so there's it to a me gently.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a logic to that. But yes, I think a lot of people will now be looking at, hey, why not max out my cash element whilst I can and just keep it there for a while?
Are there any things that you could do to mitigate the fluctuations in the market?
Yeah, so this is all about spreading your portfolio, really. So if you've got it in a FTSE 100 tracker and on FTSE All Share Tracker, they're really appealing. They're low cost. They're really easy to understand. You look up on the Times every day, it will tell you what the FTSE 100 has done. That is what your stock market performance has done. The problem with that is you're buying the dips and the volatility. So when the market is all over the place like it is now, you're all over the place. The advantage of not doing that is to have a sort of more managed fund where the stock market portfolio manager says, I'll put a bit in stocks, I'll put a bit in property, I'll put a bit in bonds. So that's sensible. The problem with that is you'd think these highly paid city boys and girls would get their sums right. There's lots of evidence to say, actually, the majority of them do worse than the cheap tracker. So whereas in theory you're spreading your risk, what often actually happens is you do worse than the tracker and they charge you for the benefit of that. So, you know, it's something of a difficult decision to make. What I would say personally is have a bit of everything. You have a bit of cash. I'll tell you what, this is what I do. So I have a bit of a cash ISA, I have a tracker, and I have a managed fund. And when I've got spare money, depending on how courageous I feel and when I think I need that money, I just decide which pot to put it in. And indeed, take it out of an ISA completely. Just put it, you know, elsewhere. You know, make sure you're paying off your debts and all of that sort of stuff.
How does anybody, the great big powers that be, know which stuff you've got in which pots?
It's a good question. I've never tried to overfund my ISA, like to put in more than £20,000 and see if I'm rejected from that. But I'm sure you can't do it. I'm sure it will catch up on you. But it's a good point. And like with pensions, there's not existing a pensions dashboard, or people keep talking about it. It should be a really obvious thing to do. And you have a sort of need like a speedometer and goes, oh, I'm up to, I'm in the red, I'm moving towards the red.
Beep, beep, beep.
Yeah, it should be doing that. It's not an easy thing to do. So I keep a rather old-fashioned spreadsheet and I put in this amount here. And so I keep track of it. And I think that's worth doing.
Yeah.
And also, if you're looking at trackers, the other thing I'd say is lots of the big brands charge you the most. And it sounds nothing. What's the difference between 1% or 0.5%? Who cares? Mm. It's the price of... When you've got a lifetime's worth of savings, you're going £50,000, £60,000, £70,000 over years. These small percentages, that's why the city is rich. Because that makes a big difference over a long term. So don't just go with the big brands on these trackers. You're basically buying the same thing from each one. If it's 1% or 0.5%, that'll make a big difference when you retire. So it is really worthwhile spending attention to that and not just thinking, who cares, it's only 0.5%.
A question from Charlotte, who says, it's all very well, but what about child trust funds that are maturing imminently?
Yeah, so this is a whole other area, child trust funds, which have been a great idea. Look, if they're maturing, there's in a way, there's not much you can do about this. They're maturing. What do you do with that money? And this is, again, something that comes down to not what's going to happen to the stock market, but your appetite for risk. Do you take that and put it in another ISA or in a stock market? Do you take it out and leave it in cash at the moment? I'm afraid this really is about your personal desire and how risk averse you are and how able you are to take a loss. If a loss is going to wipe you out, I'd go... Don't be playing in this area. Yeah. You know, really, this is really important. Go somewhere safe.
But the child trust fund is a very difficult time, isn't it? Because so many people have put into that in order to help out at university. You know, that is a fixed thing that's happening in your young adult's life.
Yeah.
So you don't have the time to say, I'll just leave it there for another 5 years and hope for the best.
And this is exactly the point I was making about stock markets in general. Don't put money in shares... If you go, I might need that tomorrow. And that actually what's happened when people come up to pension retirement age, their pension provider starts moving them out of that, because you go, what happens if you retire today? Suddenly, if you've got a pension fund or an ISA and you need to cash it in today, that would be a terrible thing for you to do. So if you need the cash at a particular point, make sure you've got it available.
Thank you very much indeed. Where can people go if they want to find out more?
On my socials and at themoneydoctor.tv and at Adam Biz on everything else.
Thank you very much, Adam. Our producer today, Hannah Quinn. Technical operator, Ryan Boyden. We're back tomorrow. John Pienaar is next with Drive. Have a good evening.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Jane. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar, and this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. Oil prices have dropped as Donald Trump postpones strikes on Iranian power plants after what he's described as productive talks. And counter-terror police are looking into the legitimacy of a group claiming responsibility for an arson attack on Jewish community ambulances in North London. And as the US president claims to have had productive conversations with Iran, what will that mean on the ground in the Middle East? I'll be talking to the foreign affairs expert, Tim Marshall, and to a former commanding general of the US First Army. And Keir Starmer has been taking questions from MPs in Parliament. Times Radio's political editor Anna Mihailova is there in the room, and she'll be updating us on it all a bit later on.
This is Times Radio.
And now the news with Eliza Phillips.
Thanks, John. Good afternoon. Sir Keir Starmer says household energy bills will be cut and then held until the end of June.
even if the conflict in Iran continues. The Prime Minister is facing questions from senior MPs and addressed concerns around fuel prices.
We've been working intensively in the last week or two with fuel suppliers to make sure that nobody is profiteering from this, and that's why we've said to the CMA they've got to be all over any price gouging, any attempts to make money.
The US president's claiming oil prices will drop like a rock as soon as a deal's made with Iran. Costs have risen with tankers effectively blocked in a key shipping route as a result of the war in the Middle East. The US president's postponed strikes on Iranian power plants, which state media in Tehran says show he's backed down.
We have major points of agreement, I would say almost all points of agreement, but we've had very strong talks. They went, I would say, perfectly. I would say that if they carry through with that, it'll end that problem, that conflict.
Well, homeowners' choice of mortgage deals has shrunk by almost a fifth in the past few weeks. This morning, there were almost 1,500 fewer options available compared to 2 weeks ago. 744 deals have disappeared since last Thursday when the Bank of England held the base rate of interest at 3.75%. Police are searching for three suspects following an anti-Semitic arson attack on four Jewish volunteer ambulances in North London earlier this morning. No injuries have been reported. The MP for Golders Green says the overnight arson attack was a symbolic attack of hatred. CCTV shows three hooded men approaching one of the vehicles and setting it alight. Sarah Sackman, who is Jewish herself, has been speaking to reporters at the scene.
Such anti-Semitism on our streets has no place. This is the beating heart of Golders Green, the beating heart of the British Jewish community. We're a stone's throw away from incredible organisations like Jewish Care, where I'll be doing my shopping ahead of Passover, which we're celebrating next week. This is a symbolic act of hatred, and it's why we must do everything in our power, working with government, working with law enforcement agencies, to ensure that the evil perpetrators of this incident feel the full force of the law.
The government is to fund the replacement of the vehicles. HS2 high-speed railway trains could be made to run slower than planned. The idea is to reduce costs. Scotland's busiest train station's reopening fully on Wednesday. Partial timetable has been operating at Glasgow Central since last week, more than a fortnight on from a fire at a nearby vape shop. To cricket, and the ECB has defended its decision to stick with Brendan McCullum as England's head coach. That's despite the dismal Ashes series, insisting that a football-style cull would only hinder the team's recovery. For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with ServiceNow.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Good news. America is discussing, and I'm quoting, a complete and total resolution of hostilities in the Middle East. That's after, and I'm quoting again, very good and productive conversations. Conversations so good, apparently, that the threat of America bombing Iranian power plants has been lifted. Well, for 5 days, anyway. So not just good news, very good news. Or it would be. Except with this qualification, that the quotes are from President Trump in a new social media post. So who really knows if a complete and total resolution of hostilities is at hand or not? The Iranian state news agency, Fars, is saying there's been no direct or indirect communication with America. Now, maybe they would say that. You could hardly take the word of Tehran for anything. But sadly, it is also close to impossible to take all that President Trump says at face value either. We can assume now, and this is worth a sigh of relief, that there'll be no US attacks on Iranian power plants when Trump's deadline, 14 minutes to midnight, for opening the vital sea route of the Strait of Hormuz, when that passes tonight. No strikes there that experts warned would amount to a war crime, which may not concern President Trump, but might worry US military leaders, or at least some of them. And the core consequence of Trump's big announcement, no economically disastrous Iranian retaliatory strikes against energy targets, as well as water targets in the Gulf states. And that is why the price of oil dropped and markets jumped steeply moments after Trump pressed send on his social media post. It is hardly cynical to believe that may have been the real aim of President Trump's announcement. We will talk about that. Send me a text, 87222. Start with the word Times or a tweet to @TimesRadio. Now, let's look at this more closely. President Trump giving the latest twist in the war in Iran, announcing on that Truth Social site there had been productive conversations with Iran after discussing a resolution to the conflict. He was speaking to reporters near Air Force One this afternoon.
So the discussions took place yesterday. They went into yesterday evening. They want very much to make a deal. We'd like to make a deal, too. We're going to get together today by probably phone because it's very hard to find a country. It's very hard for them to get out, I guess. But we'll at some point very, very soon meet. We're doing a 5-day period. We'll see how that goes. And if it goes well, we're going to end up with settling this.
President Trump also said the U.S. was not directly negotiating with the Ayatollah.
Don't forget, we've wiped out the leadership phase one, phase two, and largely phase three. But we're dealing with the man who I believe is the most respected and the leader. It's a little tough. They've wiped out everybody.
Is that the Supreme Leader?
No, not the Supreme Leader. So we don't. Well, nobody heard of the second Supreme Leader, the son.
Are these direct?
Nobody. We have not heard from the son. Every once in a while, you'll see a statement made, but we haven't. We don't know if he's living.
Well, there are unconfirmed reports that that Trump's envoys are talking to the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament. The president went into more detail about the now paused, the held-up threat to blow up Iranian power facilities if the country did not come to the table to discuss an end to the war and passage through the Strait of Hormuz.
So tomorrow morning, sometime their time, we were expected to blow up their largest electric generating plant that cost over $10 billion to build. It's a very good one. There was no dearth of money. And one shot, it's gone. It collapsed. Why would they want that? So they called. I didn't call. They called. They want to make a deal. And we are very willing to make a deal. It's got to be a good deal. And it's got to be no more wars, no more nuclear weapons. They're not going to have nuclear weapons anymore. They're agreeing to that. Any of that stuff, there's no deal.
And in the event of a deal, who would control the Strait of Hormuz?
Be a jointly controlled.
By whom?
Maybe me. Maybe me.
You want the United States to be
me and the Ayatollah, whoever the Ayatollah is, whoever the...